The Nature Podcast from Nature, the international weekly journal of science, brought to you in association with Bio-Rad. Potent silent medicinal substrate siRNAs are now available with proven performance for guaranteed 85% gene silencing. Come take a look on the web at www.biorad.com/RNAi.
In this week's Nature Podcast, how a cave in Australia is giving scientists an unprecedented glimpse into the past.
And once we descended into these caves, we discovered, scattered across the floor, a remarkable array of extinct marsupials represented by complete skeletons that in many ways represent a Rosetta Stone for unlocking the secret of the Pleistocene marsupial fauna of arid Australia.
And we'll be kicking off with Gavin Prideaux's discovery in just a moment. Also, how the US and Canada's plans to start summer early are finding favour over here too, especially with economists.
The proposed move would potentially reduce electricity costs year-round in Britain by £500 million. At a stroke, it would cut the carbon emissions of the country by the equivalent of 70,000 people, reducing their emissions to zero.
And, far from having a 10-second memory, how fish can work out who not to pick a fight with just by watching how others have fared.
The meat of it is that actually, just by watching other fish fight, the fish are essentially able to synthesize an entire hierarchy, and they do it simply by watching.
Hello, I'm Chris Smith. Welcome to this week's programme. First up this week, to a limestone cave in Australia's Nullarbor Plain. It's actually turned out to be a gold mine for scientists who are trying to piece together what kinds of animals and plants would have lived in this part of the country in the past. Here's Gavin Prideaux.
In 2002, some cavers went on an expedition out to an area called the Nullarbor Plain. Nullarbor is Latin for no trees, which is a very apt name. And the Nullarbor Plain is in the middle of Australia at the bottom. So south central Australia. It's a vast treeless expanse, and it's underlain by limestone. And within that limestone, there are literally thousands of caves. There's about 2,000 discovered to date. And in 2002, a caving party went out there, and in three of the caves, they found complete skeletons of extinct marsupials, some of which we call megafauna, giant relatives of animals that are still around today that have subsequently become extinct. And we found around 70 species of vertebrates in all, and quite a few of them were new. We found, for example, 8 entirely new species of kangaroo, ranging from things that are about a foot high up to animals that were quite large, perhaps weighing up to 100 kilos.
Were they so well preserved because they'd just been locked in this cave in ideal conditions for a very long time?
Precisely. The caves opened up around about 500,000 years ago. They may have been open, we estimate, for perhaps as much as 10,000 years or so. The entrances to the caves are quite small. The animals were bounding around if they were kangaroos or running around if they were quadrupeds and just fell down the entrances. Many of them, unlike in most cave deposits, didn't die when they actually hit the bottom but survived a fall. And then they crawled off further into the cave and collapsed and died. The caves closed up from boulders blocking their solution pipes. And then recently, perhaps in the last few hundred years, these caves have opened again, allowing us to get in there, and like an opening of a time capsule for the last 500,000 years, there we found all of these complete skeletons.
So if you analyse the soils, the material that's in there, how old is the material? When does it go back to? When's the earliest of these fossil deposits, and when's the youngest?
Well, we don't actually know how old the oldest fossils are. We know that the youngest is something around the 400,000 or 500,000 year old mark, but we know that the oldest go back to greater than 780,000. So given that we know that these caves have essentially been in their current form for at least 4 million years, we're hoping that future work will get us back to looking at faunas prior to 500,000 years, prior to 700,000 years, perhaps back to 1 million, 2 million, 4 million years.
Looking at the specimens you have got now, within this time frame, the 500,000 years or so, what does that tell you about how Australia's changed in that time?
Well, the remarkable thing is that the climate in this particular area has changed very little over the last 500,000 years, which was perhaps the most surprising thing that we discovered, because the fauna includes a great diversity of herbivorous mammals. And generally, when one thinks about an assemblage consisting of 25 or 30 herbivore species ranging up to sort of 200 or 300 kilos in size, you you think there's going to be a lot of different vegetation types around. So we were quite struck when we came to the conclusion based on some isotopic analyses and various other techniques that the climate was very similar. So we conclude that in this area, the reason that the vegetation has changed so much that it no longer could support those types of animals is that fires must have increased substantially in this area and reduced or driven to extinction a lot of the fire-sensitive vegetation upon which these animals would have been basing themselves, resulting in a grassland, shrub, steppe type environment. The climate has changed very little, but the vegetation has changed an awful lot.
Gavin Prideaux from the Western Australian Museum with what he describes as the Rosetta Stone for scientists who are trying to understand Australia's past climate, flora and fauna. Now, from sunny Australia to us here in the Northern Hemisphere and in the grip of winter. Thankfully, summer could be coming early, it seems, at least if a parliamentary vote goes the right way, as Nature's Kerry Smith and Mike Hopkin explain.
As the dark days of January wear on, at least in much of the Northern Hemisphere, you might have found yourself wishing for the long, bright days of summer. But summer is coming early to some countries this year. On March the 11th, summertime starts in the US and much of Canada a month ahead of the standard switch. The UK government is also considering legislation to move the clocks forward to provide lighter evenings all year round. I'm here with Michael Hopkin, who's put together a special report for this week's Nature on the new proposals and their potential effects. Mike, what's behind these plans?
Well, it's quite interesting because the motivations between the American and the British legislations are slightly different. America's doing it explicitly from a saving energy point of view. It's part of their energy bill, which also includes measures to improve renewable fuels and things like that, and a wide range of energy measures. But what's getting the economists excited is this idea of being able to use less energy almost for free just by extending the hours of daylight saving time in the summer by having lighter evenings, which is when most people tend to use the most power by turning on lights and things like that. You can save energy. In Britain, it's more a quality of life consideration, although they will save energy as well, but they're mainly trying to cut down on road accidents and also allow people more time for activities like sport in the evenings. And I spoke to Mayor Hillman from the Policy Studies Institute in London, who's been campaigning for this for almost two decades.
Principal benefits, in my view, will be derived from having an extra hour of daylight in the latter part of the day in exchange for losing an hour of daylight in the winter months only. We're wasting those early morning daylight hours, which can be transferred to the latter part of the day by this clock change. Additional to those benefits are the fact that we will be on the same time zone as most of Western Europe, which will facilitate travel and communications with those countries. The benefits derive from improved health, because people will be more encouraged to engage in outdoor activity. The benefits for industry of lighter afternoons, the benefits in terms of a reduction in road casualties, because there is far more activity that would be able to be undertaken during hours of daylight rather than darkness.
Well, that all sounds like quite a good idea, really. You've also been looking into the psychological effects of such a switch. Good news there too?
Yeah, I think so. It's fairly anecdotal evidence, but it does seem that it will reduce the incidence of things like seasonal affective disorder, which happens much more in the winter months where people don't get as much daylight, especially if they live at high latitudes. There's quite a spike in people suffering sort of depression and things like that when the winter nights draw in. And it is quite demoralising when the clocks go backwards again in the autumn and you get the very dark evenings.
So if the economists are happy with this, and the public are also going to be more happy because of the quality of life, what's to go wrong? Who isn't happy about this new proposal?
Well, it's an interesting question, because Britain actually trialled something quite similar to this back in the 1960s and 70s, and it was voted down because of people mostly complaining about school children in Scotland having to go to school in the dark during winter. Obviously, if you get lighter evenings, then that means darker mornings. And there was quite a lot of electioneering that went on around it. There were some quite powerful lobby groups as well. Dr. Hillman has a few ideas about why the plan was scuppered.
Parliament was persuaded, particularly by the two industries, agriculture and the building industry, that it would be wholly disadvantageous to have darker mornings. And in justification for their position, they very carelessly and deliberately cited the fact that there had been an increase during the experiment in the number of casualties on the roads in the darker winter months. What they did not acknowledge was the fact that there was a far bigger reduction in the later part of the day because of the improved lighting conditions of that extra hour of daylight in the latter part of the day. And as a result, Parliament voted in favour of the abandonment of that experiment.
So he says it was mostly the fault of the farmers and the builders complaining, but he says it wouldn't be too much trouble for them to just turn up to work an hour later in the morning. And in a survey of the electorate, it seems that 54% of British people are broadly in favour of the measure. Some of the other numbers that are coming out of the research that's supporting the proposed move would potentially reduce electricity costs year-round in Britain by almost £500 million. The politicians who are proposing it also say that at a stroke it would cut the carbon emissions of the country by the equivalent of 70,000 people, reducing their emissions to zero. So they've got quite high hopes for it. It's probably got about a 50-50 shot of being approved in the Commons because the government's not officially supporting it. It's proposed by a member of the opposition. But as regards America, that's definitely going into law this year. So it seems that it's an idea that's gaining ground.
Thanks, Mike. And now back to Chris, for whom daylight saving will make little difference since he spends most of his time in a windowless studio.
So for those of us concerned about climate change and about the size of our electricity bills, it sounds like Christmas, as well as summer, could be coming early. Thank you very much, Kerry. And incidentally, is she trying to tell me I need to get out more?
Nature's Podcast, bringing the world of nature to life.
On the way, how researchers have worked out the ideal way to sniff out your lunch or even a loved one. But first, it's time to go fishing for answers to how fish size up the opposition. Logan Grosnick's found that fish can perform what's known as transitive inference. In other words, if fish A beats fish B in a fight, and then fish B beats fish C in a different fight, another fish watching the action from a distance can deduce that fish A could also beat fish C. What Logan's done is to allow a bystander fish to watch a sequential series of fights like this between five different fish. And then the bystander was tested to see against which of two fish it preferred its chances.
We're working on a highly territorial species of fish who engage in aggressive tournaments with one another. The males fight for reproductive success and territory, so winning these fights is critical to them. And we wanted to examine a particular kind of behavior in them, which is known as transitive inference. It involves comparing things. For example, if you know that A is larger than B and B is larger than C, you're able to determine that A is also larger than C.
So if you look at it from the perspective of the fish, it means that a fish that's beaten B knows that he can also beat C, so he must be dominant and superior to fish C.
Correct. In this, we're actually interested in how these fish watch other fish beat other fish. So if I have three rivals and I see A beat rival B and B beat rival C, then I know that A could beat rival C, and I'm probably more interested in fighting with C than I am with fighting with A.
So that's actually quite a difficult thing to try to get a fish to do. So what was the experiment? How did you set it up in order to find out whether fish can do that?
We used kind of a somewhat elaborately designed tank that you can't buy in a normal store. It had a large central compartment where the bystander hung out, and then around him were arrayed five other fish who were called fish A, B, C, D, and E. And each of them was in their own unit, and all of these units were separated by opaque barriers. So none of the fish could see each other, but we could remove the barrier. So, for example, if we wanted the bystander to suddenly see fish A, we could remove this barrier, and there would be fish A.
So it's almost like a sort of peep show for fish, but instead you're asking this bystander to watch different fish in these different compartments fighting with each other.
Correct. And importantly, we're able to control which fish beats which other fish. Because these guys are so territorial, if we take one fish and call it the invader fish, let's say we take fish B and we drop it into fish A's paddock, fish A will just very aggressively go after fish B. And we also actually suspended them out of water slightly before we dropped them in, so fish B was kind of out of breath. He was stressed out, and then all of a sudden fish A is on him and he's on his heels. And you get these very clear victories in terms of A just repeatedly dominating B in front of the bystander.
So the ultimate point here would be that the bystander has now seen competitions between all these different fish and has a clear idea, hopefully in its mind, as to who is king fish and who isn't.
Correct. And they actually synthesize it over several days. We train them for several days on these fights, on A beating B, B beating C, C beating D, and D beating E. And then we test them on pairs of these fish that they've never seen interact. So A has never actually fought with E, and B has never actually fought with D. They've only seen this chain of fighting, this hierarchy that we've artificially developed for them. And then we test their choices on the fish's A and E, and B and D. B and D being the very critical choice, because B and D have both won and lost the same amount. So the only real clue to which fish is weaker is where they are in this hierarchy. And we want to see if the fish were able to learn that, essentially.
So is that what happens?
What happens is when we finally take these fish and take the bystanders, the central fish who have seen these fights, we put them in a long tank between fish B and D, and we kind of lift up both barriers at once, and all of a sudden both of those fish are there. They spend almost all of their time near fish D, treating it like it were a weaker fish, meaning that they've learned this hierarchy of the fish simply by watching these pairwise fights between them.
And this is all done by visual guidance?
All done visually. The bystander has never encountered these fish before, never encounters the fish during the course of the experiment. He just watches them again in the, as you said, the fish peep show of sorts.
Stanford University's Logan Grosnick, who's shown that fish of the species Astatotilapia betoni can work out, just by watching their rivals in a fight, who's the top dog fish. Now, on the subject of animals with a keen sense of smell, if you want to track down the source of a weak odour, what's the best strategy? Do you sit tight and keep sniffing to work out where it's coming from, or do you go looking for the source at the risk of going in the wrong direction and then losing the scent altogether? Well, Boris Schreiman's developed a mathematical algorithm, which he calls infotaxis, to solve the problem. And his solution, which actually mimics behaviours seen naturally in moths, might also help bomb disposal teams.
We've been trying to find a good way of finding a source of odour and what the best search strategy might be. I play this little game with my children, hide a chocolate bar, and then they go around looking for it, and I tell them it's getting hotter or it's getting colder. And, of course, if I don't give them this clue, they'll be quite lost. So the question is, how do animals, that nobody gives clues like that, go about finding the equivalent of a chocolate bar? What we understand well about this process is how microscopic organisms might be able to do it. For example, bacteria can move towards a source of food, and they do it by detecting the level of concentration. Is it getting hotter or colder?
Well, that's bacteria. But what about when you kind of zoom out and you start considering the average moth that's fluttering around and it can smell its mate and track down its mate a mile or two away just using smell? If you look at the anatomy of the smell signal coming from the distant moth, I mean, what does that look like?
Well, it's a very different situation because of the turbulence in the atmosphere. The odor comes chopped up into little puffs and tendrils. Think of a smoke plume, which is a very wispy. The level of smoke that you see locally doesn't really tell you where it's coming from. So that's a different situation, and that's precisely the problem that we're trying to tackle with.
So I suppose really there's two ways to approach that, isn't there? If you were the moth, you could sit there and just watch what happened with the smoke, or sniff in this instance, and you could gather as much information as you could, or you could choose to fly around and see if you got more information. There's, of course, a payoff that if you went and flew in the wrong direction, you'd lose information.
Yes, Chris, exactly. Sitting in one place and waiting for a long time, you can get a very accurate reading of the level of odorant, and in fact, you would be able to calculate its gradient, which tells you which direction to go. But the problem is, if you're far from the source, you're getting so few puffs, you would have to wait for a very, very long time to get enough to get this information. And there is a better way of doing it. If you don't get enough odor, you start walking and look for it actively. And the whole trick is to figure out how much to wait and how fast to move and how to bias the direction in which you're going to search to make the search faster.
Now, you've got this algorithm put together. So if you compare it and what it predicts with what we actually see happening in the real world, in nature, do the two map onto each other?
I think it basically gives us ideas about how to think about what moth actually does. To really confront the theory with observations, we would need a much more quantitative observations. And what we get from the theory are the suggestions for what exactly are the quantitative measures that would be good to take in the field that we could then compare with the theory.
But in the near term, there must be enormous numbers of industrial spin-offs and technological applications for this model.
This is certainly the part which is most immediate. Many people are trying to devise robotic sniffers that would go after gas leaks and plastic explosives, and our algorithm can be just programmed on the computer and is a practical prescription for how the search might proceed once the hardware is in place.
Boris Schramann from UC Santa Barbara with a mathematical model of how larger animals and even bomb disposal systems can most efficiently go in search of smells. Well, that's it for this week, and thank you very much for listening. Do join me next time when I'll be finding out how bacteria look out for each other. If you'd like to send us some feedback about the Nature podcast, we'd love to hear from you. Please do drop us a line to podcast@nature.com. And don't forget that all of the reports we've discussed in this week's podcast are also on our website at nature.com/nature. Now, for more science in the meantime, you might like to check out this week's edition of the Naked Scientist podcast, which looks at the question of climate change, alternative energy, and carbon sequestration. That's the Naked Scientist podcast that's freely available from thenakedscientist.com. Once again, thanks for listening to the Nature podcast. I'm Chris Smith, and until next time, goodbye!
The Nature podcast is sponsored by Bio-Rad, at the centre of scientific discovery for over 50 years, and on the web at discover.biorad.com.